Good evening, everyone. Good evening. You've tuned into Paradigm Shifters. Now, this Paradigm Shifter can help you integrate a very, very vast, vast awakening or awareness to, what the universe is really doing and how alive it really is. And I'll let him tell you about it. Welcome to the show, Dwayne Elgin.
Thank you, Veronica. Good to be here.
Now, did I say your name right, Elgin or Elgin?
You know, I think technically it's Elgin. And but I am totally happy with either Elgin or Elgin.
Well, I probably won't use it a lot while we talk, but
yeah,
we are
going to... Call me Dwayne.
Okay, Dwayne. Welcome to the show, and we're going to talk about your amazing book. And I considered it amazing because it brings so many levels of existence together in a really poetic statement. The living universe. Who are we? Where are we going? Simple question. Can you answer that for me?
Oh, easily. Easily.
Well, the living universe, that whole concept, let's talk about that a little bit, because that's a wonderful, wonderful. I don't know. I found that elevating and releasing as I read about the description, some of the descriptions
right.
of it.
You know, my sense is perhaps the deepest wound that humanity, and particularly we in the United States and the Western world have, the deepest wound, psychic wound that we have, is our separation from the universe. And we separate ourselves from the universe when we say it's essentially non-living at the foundations, dead at the foundations. And that's what science has been saying for about the last 300 years. Science has been saying, look, the universe is basically inert matter and empty space, and there's a little bit of live stuff around, and that's you. And when you look at the world that way, the universe that way, everything around you that way, immediately all the stuff around you becomes dead stuff to exploit on behalf of the living, and that's me. And it naturally generates this exploitive mindset. And on the other hand, if we go back to like the Plato's insight, Plato said the universe is a single living creature that encompasses all living creatures within it. Now, if we look at the universe like Plato did and say, hey, wait, this is alive, or like the indigenous peoples and so on, then instead of exploiting it, we're going to revere it. We're going to say, boy, I need to be in a reverential, sacred relationship with the totality of all of this and be in a place of gratitude and reverence with this universe and use what is there from that mindset, that consciousness. So it is a profound shift that is actually underway right now, not only in spirituality, but also in science. And those two traditions are now coming together to point to a universe that is alive.
I really like that. It really touches, one section, this is farther into the book, where you talk about love. And our capacity to experience our existence in a state of love or to deepen into what love really is. As you explain the universe that way, it's easier to feel that, is it not? Is it easier to feel the love with the universe as opposed to I am on it and will my life be okay or I'm in it, you see?
Absolutely. Here's one of the key things. It brings in love. But it says, well, is that something we generate inside of our bodies? Somehow the biochemistry of the body generates this biochemical feeling called love. Or is it something else? Is it some kind of deeper...
Is it a rapport is what I'm
saying. Is it a rapport, a communion, a connection with the aliveness of another person, with the universe, with the with nature? Is that perhaps what love is? Now, if the universe is alive and we're a part of that aliveness, then when life meets life, we might call that love. And so if our aliveness touches the aliveness of an animal, of a plant, of the world around us, and we awaken to that aliveness, we might say, wow, and call that love.
That's wonderful, because you just used the word awaken. I think that's part of it, isn't it? Is waking up to this amazing life that's here. Who are you, Dwayne? How come you know so much?
Well, let's see. I grew up on a farm, and
that helps a lot, doesn't
that
it?
That helps a lot. Mm-hmm. Basically, I'm just a farmer at heart, and I just grew up with the land, with the animals, and all the rest, and was gifted with the opportunity to really fall in love with life and the land at a very early age, and not be distracted by all of the video games and television shows and this and that that we have today. It was just a very simple life. And then I had just the good fortune of various opportunities to learn and to meditate and to learn and explore and discover. So I've just been a very fortunate soul.
And you've never been off to war or Vietnam or any of those things?
Well,
That sounded like a non sequitur, but I just think that can sort of dampen.
Yeah, it was very important in my life in that I was studying to be a doctor, and then during the war I was being asked to go kill people, and it was just a profound challenge to my consciousness and conscience, and basically I shifted from physical healing to social healing. And so the Vietnam War was very, very important for me to make a commitment to social healing and finding a way beyond violence to live together on this earth.
Oh, so you were a conscious subjector?
Not formally, but rather I was in school and fortunate enough to stay in school to really stay out of the draft.
Excellent.
But I was very active in the anti-war movement, not against the soldiers, but against the government policies or putting those soldiers in that harm's way.
Mm. So you had it right in your soul and you managed to work with it. You didn't get slammed up against that wall, which was a good thing, hey?
Yeah, well, it slammed me for years, actually, and so it really tested whether my commitments as a, for a lot of us. So,
Oh, so it's a real refinement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you started. What did you study? Did you actually become a physician?
No, I ended up getting a master's, an MBA from the Wharton Business School, and then another master's in economic history. And then I went off, and my first job was working on a presidential commission in Washington, D.C., looking at the long-term future from 1970 to the year 2000, 30 years into the future. And I tell you, for a farm boy from Idaho to be plopped down on a presidential commission, that was an education. And boy, was I surprised. I thought someone would be minding the store, looking ahead, concerned about the future. I mean, that's what government is about. And so I had the opportunity to call up the Department of Education, Transportation, you name it, and say, what are your plans for the longer-term future? And they'd say, what do you mean? You know, the next 6 months, 12 months, 2 years, no, the next 30. Well, no one was looking ahead. The longest term people were looking ahead was essentially the presidential cycle, 4 years, and realistically it was the budget cycle, 1 year. And so we, as a nation, are driving blind. That's what I got. Again and again and again, we're driving with politics and we're driving blind when it means looking into the future. And boy, I tell you, that's dangerous in a changing world.
That's really interesting. I had a similar experience, which I won't go into, but it does really change your thinking about where the power really is. And it's interesting here you're talking about the living universe, and there's a real empowerment all the way through your book. It's very... So you went off, and you must have studied other things besides politics. And
oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I worked with the... after leaving that presidential commission, my first job, I worked at a think tank in California, and my first job was working with a small team of scholars that included Joseph Campbell, one of the world's foremost scholars of the world's history and spirituality and culture and all the rest. And we wrote a book.
And really, the depth of human power, depth of the power of our architects, our archetypes.
The deep archetypes, the deep images that we hold of ourselves. And we co-authored a book called "Changing Images of Man." Images of Man. And so we were trying to understand what is the image that humanity could hold of itself that would draw us into a more positive, life-affirming future. And so that was our exploration, and that was, that was in 1974.
Wow. Well, that would be really formative in terms of a drive, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I've been, and after that work and working for the president's science advisor, I decided I'd learned enough. Our world is in deep trouble, given the driving trends of climate and population and all the rest. And I left in 1976. I left the think tank, SRI, and I've been working on my own ever since.
Wonderful.
And I've been working as an activist for a transforming future. So it's been a very interesting enterprise.
Well, Duane, do I remember this correctly? Did you also spend some time in the monastery over in Tibet or being a monk?
No. No, I did spend a half year in meditation after leaving SRI, trying to discern, you know, my life path. And
SRI is
the Stanford Research Institute.
And they were exploring human capabilities and consciousness.
Well, it was the world's second largest think tank with 2,000 or 3,000 people.
Oh, my.
And where I was in a small group of a dozen or so people doing futures research.
Yay.
And then I also got involved with another group there in the engineering labs doing parapsychology research, psychic research, the remote viewing research. For 3 years.
So can futures research and parapsychology, can they come together really well to create a bigger picture?
Well, they might, but I tell you, you wouldn't want to say that to the president's science advisor that, we used our psychic abilities and here's what we have to tell the president. that just would not, that is not going to work, I assure you.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Well, okay, so now you've got a lot of research here in this book called The Living Universe, and
right.
It's from one of the intriguing things, many of the intriguing things there, but one of them that I liked was that you have brought in bits and pieces or comments from probably every maybe a spiritual thought process that's gone on
right.
in the history of mankind, all the religions and the great teachers.
Right.
You've done some tremendous study there.
Right. It took over 30 years to write the book. And basically, I was asking the question of the book titled The Living Universe. When you go to the world's wisdom traditions, what do they say? What do they say about the universe? Do they say anything at all? Doesn't even matter. Do the things that they say about the universe, are they in common with other traditions? I didn't know, and because it had never been gathered together. So I spent decades going into multiple translations of, say, the Bhagavad Gita or other materials, looking for their descriptions of the universe. And here's what came back. There is a profound level of consistency across the world's wisdom traditions, and this is the place, I think, above all else, or below all else, or whatever, that the world's wisdom traditions, religions, spiritual traditions, whatever, this is where they connect. And in saying that not only is the universe alive, but it's regenerative. It is being recreated at every moment. And this is stunning. And this is an insight that physics is only now beginning to validate. And it is an amazing insight. And it is that the world, the entire universe, is being recreated moment by moment by moment by moment. And then, now, so if we step back and say, well, let's understand this. If you go to a movie, and if the movie is projecting more than 16 frames a second, the mind makes it look seamless. Now, the universe is projecting itself at a very high rate of speed, way more than 16 frames a second.
Nice.
And we are watching it at a really pretty slow rate of speed. You're just kind of lazy, kind of watching along. And it appears to us as being seamless. But every one of the world's spiritual traditions says that if you really, really, really watch precisely, closely, you will begin to see the universe is regenerating itself. A new universe is being created at every moment.
Hmm.
Now, you know, for example, in Islam, they call this occasionalism. They say that if I'm holding a book, the next moment, it'll not be the same book it was before. It'll be the new occasion of that book. And not only the occasion of the book, but also the entire universe holding that book.
Wow, what a wonderful concept. It's a little hard to hold it.
Oh, well, it is. See, it is hard to hold. This mm-hmm. is stunning because it means that we are a part of that regenerative process.
Mm-hmm.
And at every moment, the life force of a living universe is recreating us as well as the entire universe. And if we relax into where we are moment by moment by moment, we are relaxing into the life force, into the flow through of a living universe.
Hmm.
And that universe has obviously immense intelligence. And we can relax into the immense intelligence, love, and knowing of a living universe. And to the extent that we think that it's not alive, we'll cut ourselves off from that aliveness.
Mm-hmm.
To the extent that we think it is alive, we can relax into it. So it really, really does make a big difference. And I want to come back to where we started love. And it is that if you ask someone that spent years in meditation, what is it like? Do you find this kind of gray metallic hum at the foundation of it all? Or is something else there? And people just spend a long time in deep meditation say, no, it's not the gray metallic hum of a dead universe. It is the juicy, electric, luminous aliveness of a living universe, and one of its deep qualities is love.
Mm-hmm.
And so we come back to it, but love is one of the qualities of a living universe. And we, in our thought minds, existential minds, cutting ourselves off from that living universe, then create, a lifeless, unloving place.
So tell me this. Do our minds design what it is we experience then? You see what I'm saying? It's like you're saying the love and the movement of the universe and the absolute rebirth that's going on all the time actually
yeah.
happens through us, but yeah. our mind stops it or
yes.
stops it for us?
Yes. I've done that. I had the opportunity of watching myself cut myself off from the universe
mm-hmm.
for years.
Hmm.
In laboratory settings, and where it was measurable that I was that I was into my kind of existential cutoff self. And
what does that mean? That you were controlling outcomes, or you wanted to design
yeah,
it?
It was me and it, and there was me here. There was an experiment there, and it was separating. And the universe is such that if we're willing to not be separate, but rather be in communion, to be in participation, to be in dance with the universe, it'll dance with us. But that's a different way of approaching things. Like in the U.S. society right now, you know, domination is where people look to. Like, you know, where's the power?
Mm-hmm.
But what we're talking about is how the universe works, and it says, where's the dance?
Mm.
Because if you try to power the universe, you're up against this is not a winning proposition. But if you're willing to dance with the universe, wow, now that's a different matter.
Then its power works with you.
Yes.
Hmm. That's really interesting, isn't it? So let's go back into the religious or the spiritual tenets or concepts that are at the basis of Christianity, Judaism, and so on. Is it all the same? And I know Taoism has the universe moving through in a certain kind of pulse, and doesn't it?
Oh, indeed. Taoism says, the Tao gives rise to all things, and the Tao is the mother universe. It isn't just the universe. It is the mother universe. I love that phrase coming from Taoism. And in Christianity, there are very specific statements from Christianity. Here's in the New Testament, I'm going to just read one. This is Hebrews 11:3. We read, the universe was formed at God's command so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. So then it goes into saying, well, it isn't just a one-time creation, but as the Pope was saying, it's continuous creation that is going on, continuous creation rather than a one-time process. So in Christianity, in Catholicism, we have the notion of a dynamic process that's flowing through us at every moment. Here's one more quote from Christianity from this from the 1300s, this Christian mystic and theologian, Meister Eckhart. He said, God is creating the entire universe fully and totally in this present now. Everything God created, God creates now, all at once. Now, it doesn't get any more specific than that to say the universe is getting created now, the whole thing, all at once. Now, that's that's from Christianity, and we've said it's from Taoism. We've seen it in Islam. How about, for example, in Hinduism?
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to Hinduism, the Bhagavad Gita, one of the foundational writings written well over 2,000 years ago, says the entire universe is pervaded by me, all depends upon me, and me is the great Brahman, the underlying life force. I do not depend upon anything else. I am the origin or seed of all things. There is nothing animate or inanimate that can exist without me. And basically it's saying that there is this underlying life force that's animating, that's giving birth, giving rise to things at every moment, and it is a dance of creation that is going on all the time. And one of the key mythologies in Hinduism is the cosmic dance of Shiva. Shiva is the god that dances the universe into existence moment by moment by moment. Mm-hmm. So we have it explicitly in Hinduism as well.
I like this. I've got that quote. I've got a page of that quote that you read part of, and it says, also, the creator exists in the creation by pervading everything. And I like that a lot. It's like,
yes.
It takes the big little, the whole thing, and puts it to me anyway in the cellular structure.
We are that. And we don't realize that. I mean, it looks one way. And that's the value of meditation, is to really refine the precision of attention, to really see into ordinary reality into a more full way, and how we actually are participating.
Well, I guess the now, being in the now, is like that too, eh?
That is it. And in physics, that's all that's going on is a regenerative process. If the entire universe is being recreated moment by moment by moment, well, and that is why the now is so powerful, is that's where creation is happening. And that's why being in the moment is so sourceful of insight. It's because that's where the life force is flowing through us. So being in the now is just not an arbitrary time kind of issue. It is being to stand in the center of the life force of a living universe.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. And I noticed as an activist, you have ways of applying this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm flipping through my book, but I think we could just talk about you applying it to what we're seeing as real life, or the election, or media. Media, that's a good thing.
Right, all right, if we think about humanity's development, we're at a stage right now, really at a very critical turning point in our development, where we are about to hit an evolutionary wall, where with population, resources, the environment, and all the rest are converging to create essentially the perfect storm of a world in systems crisis. And that means we have to take a hard look at ourselves and how we want to move into the future. Now, so then the question is, well, what do you mean take a hard look at ourselves? Okay, that's a good phrase. What do you mean? Well, then the question is, well, where is the social mirror that shows ourselves to ourselves? And I say it's the mass media. It is the mass media that represents the collective mirror through in which we see ourselves reflected as a species. And it's also the window through which we see the rest of the world. But take it as a mirror for a minute. What kind of image are we showing ourselves? Mm-hmm. We are showing ourselves. The average person, by the way, watches about 4 hours of television a day in the U.S.
Oh, my gosh.
They see more than 25,000 commercials a year on television. Now, so what is this mirror telling us? Well, it's telling us, well, you're a consumer. You are what you consume. Citizenship is just irrelevant. It's just not even on the screen. Consume. You are what you buy. There's a whole set of values that go behind that.
Fashion.
And so television is mesmerizing, hypnotizing the mass mind into an evolutionary track that I think is highly dangerous. Mm-hmm. And so let's go back. How do we really apply these insights? Well, the first thing that you do in psychotherapy and meditation and whatever is sit there on the cushion, let's say you're in meditation, and you take a hard look at yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Sit there and you say, I'm just looking. I'm not trying to change it. I'm just seeing. And what we need to do as a society is to use our mass media not to distract ourselves, but to really see ourselves. And in the seeing is transformation. And if we sit here and we see, look, it will be inherently transformative. But we are distracting rather than orienting ourselves. We're entertainment rich, we're knowledge poor, and we are just not informing ourselves at a level to run a modern democracy. And so the first step, I think, is to up-level the level of reflection, communication, dialogue by using the mass media for more mature purposes, let's say, to serve our society.
Mm-hmm. To give people, what was I reading about the knower and the known and the perceiver and the perceived? We have that ability to be all of that. Don't
Oh, absolutely.
And
definitely.
In that, there's action, right?
Yeah. Yes.
How do we change it like that? How do we get it going, Dwayne? Well, some of us are working on BBS radio for that reason, you know?
It is. See, it is getting going in that if you look around the world, what's happening right now, it is ferment. And you look to the Middle East, Arab Spring. That is still underway. That has not resolved itself. There's a lot of awakening of the democratic spirit and also the spirit of dignity, human dignity.
Mm-hmm.
That, in turn, catalyzed initiatives in Russia, for example, and a crackdown there. We've had the Occupy movement here as well as the Tea Party movement. People are saying, look, governing processes are not serving us. We're going to take back life for ourselves. And so we're in the midst of people stepping forward in many different ways, but saying, look, I'm going to try and create a better future for ourselves because our institutions are failing us.
Well, one thing I wanted to throw in is, do you think there's a predictive element, for example, in biblical things like it's the book of Revelations, which is an essential, period we need to go through in order to see better?
Well, I think if you in the following sense, we are going through a time of initiation.
Right.
We're going through a rite of passage.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what we call it. I mean, different. If you go into psychology, they'll call it something, into spirituality, something else. But the point is, we are in deep trouble, and with all of these powerful adversity trends, the climate, population, resources, environment, and they are all converging.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to converge within 10 years, is my best guess. And when they do, we will have to come together into this fire of initiation. And that might be the time of revelation, where we wake up to new possibilities as a human family and create that thriving, flourishing future, the Garden of Eden here for ourselves. But we have some hard work and learning to do to reconcile ourselves to living sustainably on this earth.
Mm-hmm.
We're divided in so many ways that not only rich and poor and cross ethnic and religious lines, but also gender. We're divided by generations. We're consuming it all now. We're not leaving a lot for the future. We're divided by species. We're killing off all these other species. And so on. So we got an enormous amount of reconciliation to do, and that is what we're going into, the fire of initiation, to reconcile ourselves to living together on this small planet in a way that flourishes, and where we put our attention on what really matters, and that is learning how to live in a living universe, I think.
Well, it's interesting to me. I'm just playing with these concepts, which I do. I love the living universe concept, but I go, would the living universe feel the loving solutions to these situations, or does the living universe feel the need to burn it out? You see what I mean?
I'm not sure I understand.
Okay, does it have to be like a horrible calamitous time, or can we pick up on consciousness and awaken even in a tumultuous style over the next years?
Yes, it absolutely we can. We can awaken, absolutely. And that's the amazing thing about consciousness and choice, conscious evolution. Here's what we can do. We can use our mass media, and we can present to ourselves futures that we do not want. A future of real calamity, where we do not pull together in cooperation, but pull apart in conflict. And let's take a look at how that plays out. And let's use the mass media to make movies and all the rest. And then we can also make movies about futures where we pull together in cooperation and work for both freedom and fairness. We want freedom from, and we want fairness. But we're learning to work together cooperatively in that spirit to create a new future for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So if we wake up, we can choose this by thinking through with our collective imagination. But if we don't wake up, if we continue to be distracted by the mass media and all the rest,
mm-hmm.
And just drift into the future, sleepwalk into the future, we're going to hit this evolutionary wall within a decade, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And we are then going to wake up and say, wow, are we in danger? We're going to probably pull apart in conflict, and we are going to veer off in that likelihood into a new dark age, future ruin. So this is really a pivotal time for the human family to wake up, use its tools of mass communication to begin to talk to itself, imagine futures.
Well, some of that's happening with the internet, isn't it? Some people around the world, people are connecting, and I think it's helped a lot in the Middle East countries and with women and
completely. Here's the what I see happening, and it's fascinating. It is that the internet. Let's say someone is out there with a cell phone in one of the Arab countries.
Mm-hmm.
The internet reaches is very narrow. it's one, say, one person or a few people. It's very narrow, but can reach very deep. You could be right there on the scene in the streets. On the other hand, television is very shallow, but it reaches very widely, very broadly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you take those two together, TV that's shallow but broad, and the Internet, which is very narrow but deep, put those two together, you have a revolution in communications.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what is now happening in the Arab countries, as well as in the Occupy movement and so on. We have the narrow connecting with the broad, and we have a new kind of communication mix emerging in the world, which is a way, in a sense, the global brain is getting wired, the global brain is waking up, and we have a new superpower on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And that superpower is the collective intelligence, the collective consciousness of ordinary citizens, seemingly powerless, standing shoulder to shoulder in their collective consciousness to say this world can work in a more affirming, positive way.
Mm-hmm.
And in a nonviolent way, we are going to stand for that dignity and that possibility.
But we have a few, a little underbrush to cut out first, don't we?
it's getting worked on by, yeah.
But it is there are people growing in terms of sustainability, for example, all over the world. And I also noticed, you know, we just are hoping that it gets bigger, right? But I also noticed you were writing about community consciousness, which I hear a lot about. And I don't know how to go from how we live into community lifestyle. Do you have things that you could say about that? I know you've written about
it. Oh, yeah. We created a society where someone looked at our housing tracts and said, you know, this is like a small, underdeveloped country because you have all of these capacities that are separated from one another. And if you could somehow take all of these individual houses and the capacities within them and begin to integrate them, you'd have much more than the sum of the parts.
Right.
Now, I've lived in co-housing for years, several years, and I saw the potential for a community of...
What exactly is co-housing, Duane?
It'd be like a... imagine a condominium that held 70 people, but it included a common house for meals and dancing and gatherings. And everyone had their own private space, but they could all... garden together and have common meals together and all the rest. And the condominium wasn't a normal one because it had been designed to be ecologically sustainable and all the rest.
Mm.
And so co-housing is just a way of living together in community, preserving your privacy, really, but also allowing you to be engaged in community. In your meals, in your landscaping process, in your maybe helping out tsunami victims with collective aid or whatever it might be, is a community.
And energy and, resources and water and so on.
Yeah. Now, there's not only co-housing, let's say, but there's retrofitting where you have existing housing and you say, well, let's recreate the architecture here so we can create a larger sense of community. There's also pocket neighborhoods where you say, okay, we have a cul-de-sac here. Let's kind of change this into a tiny little neighborhood in and of itself. There's something else called eco-villages, and that's where it's even bigger, where you bring in the commercial space integrated with the residential space, and you begin then to have an integrated place of living. And so that's the kind of thing that's going on. People are this is invention at the first order of figuring out new architectures and new social architectures for living that really are much more satisfying than the alienating lives that many of us have in the suburbs and cities.
It's very exciting. And so you're living in that. When you're talking, okay, my brain is going into mass media and the common understandings in the religious sects that are often working against each other. We have a lot of like flows that we can look at, and these are things to be talking about in the mass media, aren't they?
The thing I find heartening is that if we wanted, we could sit down, I believe, after decades of work, with every one of the world's wisdom traditions, the indigenous cultures, the Taoists, the Islamists, and Christians, and all of us, on and sit down and say, okay, let's step back here for a minute and say, where are we?
Mm-hmm.
Where are we? What kind of place are we in?
And what's don't talk the about core?
Don't talk about ourselves. Just mm-hmm. kind of let ourselves go for a minute. Where are we? And I feel in many different languages, each tradition would say, we live in a living universe.
Okay.
That's really important.
It is.
Okay, if the thing is alive, then what? It transforms everything. It transforms our sense of identity. A dead universe tells no stories. It doesn't care. But a living universe is a massive story, and we are stories within it. Our life matters profoundly in a living universe. We are part of that aliveness. We feed into the aliveness at every moment. It feeds us at every moment. So if we start by saying, where are we? And we say, well, we're in a living universe. Okay, then that begins to transform. Well, then, golly, consumerism makes sense in a dead universe, but simplicity makes sense in a living universe. You want to get rid of the clutter, complexity, and such that keeps you from engaging in the juice of aliveness.
Mm-hmm.
So right there on the spot, you have transformed. You could have, as you said, Veronica, use the mass media. Let's look at how these different religions regard the universe and discover the deep understandings that we all share.
Yeah.
And then having shared that, then say, okay, well, let's just speak from that, and not get into our, let's say, dogmatic differences right away. See what I'm saying?
Yeah, and those dogmatic differences are like clutter in a sense. I mean, they're things that define us rather than the flow, right?
And it may constrain us. So it's just to kind of give a fresh start from consensus, from mm-hmm. where we coming from agreement rather than starting from disagreement. Say, wow, we really profoundly, deeply have a foundation of agreement. And it's understandable because we are all human beings, we all live in the same universe, so it would make sense that we would have these experiences. You know, it's interesting, in the U.S., half century ago, about a quarter of the American public said they had had a profound mystical experience, half century ago, a quarter. Today, it's half. It's actually 49%.
Wow.
But half of the American adult population says, yes, I've had a profound mystical experience. And by that, they mean, I have felt my connection with a living universe. I have felt love at the foundation of it all. I have felt a sense of great peace and communion with the entire cosmos. Hmm. Those kinds of qualities. So we are now shifting from a nation of materialists to a nation of mystics, if you will.
Well, you know, here's something fun for me, and you know that I am an intuitive anyway, reading this, I'm going, the way you've described the living universe, I feel like the journey that I'm on or you're on as a soul in this particular persona at this time, it's just so, I just feel the impermanence of my life in a wonderful information accruing or experience accruing cellular journey. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And I just want to jump to something from mass media. I like to catch what's coming up on stories that might sell some greater concepts. Anyway, there's a new show called Shining Hope. I don't know if it's Saving Hope. I don't know if it's great so far. I've seen it twice. But it's one of those... the hospital drama shows.
Uh-huh.
Only the it's all about a doctor who dies and he leaves his body and he's wandering around the hospital and how various people, when they die, he meets them and he helps somebody who's also in a coma get back into his body. And I'm going, wow, they're making it real. And I just am hopeful that it's the kind of cellular expression that helps people get out of the little confinement of... do you know what I'm saying? The fashion
right.
and the ego and all that stuff.
Right.
So maybe things are happening on different levels. Maybe.
Oh, indeed they are. I mean, mm-hmm. it is utterly revolutionary what's happening in the world right now. Like, for example, stories. One story we have is that we're just little tiny creatures in this vast universe.
Right.
And so we don't matter. We're just these little specks of nothing, and just in this immensity. Now, science has now learned, if you had a ruler that went from the very largest scale, that immense scale, up to the biggest they know of, down to the very, very, very small scale, and they put humans on that scale from the biggest to the small, we would be a little more than halfway up that ruler, which means we are giants. Truly, in the cosmic scale of things, we're giants.
And is that because we have a huge presence even way out there?
No, it means this is just physical.
Okay.
It's literally physical. And this is stunning. And here's what it means. It means there is more smallness inside of us than there is bigness beyond us. There's more smallness inside than there is bigness outside.
Hmm.
And this is stunning news. And it means if we sit very quietly and look within, we are looking into a vast enormity of dynamism and flow and space and aliveness and far beyond what we might think, because we are giants.
Hmm.
And what giants overlook are things at the very small, and that's what I'm talking about. And that's where I think the energy of the intuitive flow emerges. So that's just one way we're re-perceiving ourselves. Well,
mm-hmm.
We're giants here in a living universe. Oh, instead of specks in a dead universe. So we're really changing who we think we are and what we're doing here. So our job is, I think, just kind of summarizing, is to if we're learning how to live in a living universe, it's discover ourselves. And physics says this, as well as spirituality. We're beings of light. Physics says the photons are the basis for building the universe.
Hmm.
Spirituality, again and again, talks about, are you a being of light? Are you enlightened? And so on. So we're beings of light. We're beings of love, as we already spoke about.
Beings of light is that's the building block of matter, is it not? Isn't that?
It's a building block of matter, but it's also the expression of spirit.
Mm-hmm.
So we're beings of light, love, music, and knowing. So we're light, we're love, we talked about, we're music. Physics talks about string theory.
Yeah, a little bit about the music. I think that's a pretty interesting subject.
Totally. Music, physics talks about string theory. String theory says that there is nothing called matter, but rather these tiny vibrating loops or strings. And depending upon the frequency of vibration, they accumulate, they add up into structures called matter. So, and that's one of the founding kind of views in physics, is string theory. But if you go to the wisdom traditions, every one of them has their appreciation of music, the great sound of the universe in its original creation. And song and singing and music and all the rest is just fundamental to spiritual traditions, chanting and all the rest, for being in resonance with the resonance of the universe. So we're beings of light, love, music, and lastly, knowing. If a flow of the universe is through us, if we are living in the flow of a living universe, well, then we don't have to go anywhere to tap into the intelligence of that vast universe. It's flowing through us all the time. What we need to do is learn how to relax our thinking mind and relax into the intelligence that's already there flowing through us and receive it. So that's what I think we have to learn, is to recognize ourselves, these invisible qualities that we have, that we're beings of light, love, music, and knowing. And that's why we're here. We're biodegradable. Our bodies are biodegradable vehicles for acquiring these soul-growing experiences.
So that's the soul-grow. I like that a lot. It's like you got that feeling all the way through your book that it is about such a much greater existence than the grabbing little afraid part we are. Eh?
Uh-huh.
Makes you less afraid.
Indeed. It's just awesome. For example, to look out at the universe and say, wow, it's an amazingly enormous universe. And then science comes along in the last 10 years or whatever and says, look, that's only 4%. 96% is invisible. We don't know what it is. We'll call it dark energy, dark matter. Call it dark because we can't see it. We don't know what it is. But everything we do see is only 4% of what exists. And that 4% is 99.99% empty.
That's impossible to imagine, isn't
it? It's just impossible. So we need to just radically let go of our solidity and move into flow.
Well, you know something else? This is jumping back to the beginning of your book. You were talking about how we think we're so far along on the evolutionary scale,
right.
But actually, right. Do you want to talk about that? Our world has
sure.
just been born, or
what? Here we are, people, you know, everyone says we live in three dimensions, world of three dimensions. Physics comes along and says, no, we think there's four, that's Einstein. And other physicists come along and say, you know, it appears that the universe has an infinite number of dimensions, not just two or three or four, but infinite number of dimensions. And if you think about it, well, one dimension is the collapse of everything into one clump. That's a black hole. And here we are at the second, third, fourth, and we're just a couple of steps above a black hole where it all collapses. And so that suggests to me, if there are just an infinite number of dimensions, we're not in the 3,000th dimension, 300th dimension, 30th dimension. We're down here in the third. Well, we're just getting started. It seems to me we're just crawling out of the constraints of, let's say, the black hole world. And if we can get a hold of ourselves, recognize ourselves as bodies of light, love, music, and knowing, we can move into other ecologies with much more spaciousness, much more freedom, and continue our learning. Because what we're doing is learning how to live in a living universe, and that universe has an infinite range of, I feel, learning. Opportunities for us, and we are just getting started, and the first step in getting started is to recognize ourselves. Get a hold of yourself.
Get a hold of yourself.
Yeah.
Well, so does that require, okay, so the way you're talking, I go, well, we are so possible, we have no concept of how possible we are.
Yeah.
And so does that require death? Does that require the ending of this particular life form for me to become more multidimensional?
Oh, sure. Every one of us, the life force that we carry has been alive since the beginning of all beginnings. It's like fire, you know, fire to fire to fire to fire. The chain of life goes all the way back. And so we as beings have been alive since the beginning of all beginnings. And in the moment, all those beings are folded in and they're emerging now. We embrace a vastness of learning and evolution and emergence, and we participate in that in ways that I am just beginning to. It's just an immensity beyond mental understanding, if you will.
Just
but we can
knowing.
Appreciate it. We can open our appreciative self to it.
It's huge. Thanks. This is huge concepts. Isn't it wonderful?
Yeah. It is. And it's coming to us not from science, from these science, which is so powerful that it's undoing itself. Science had these ideas about the universe, but the tools of science are so powerful, it is changing itself. Like I just said, you know, 96% of the known universe is invisible. Okay, science is this mind-blowing to science. So, and the wisdom traditions, they're democratizing. For the first time in thousands of years, we can begin to see what each one of the world's wisdom traditions says about things. For example, the universe. And
about love. Every one of them has
about,
a lot about love.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
yeah.
It is extraordinary, the awakening, the learning, the convergence that is happening right now, and just in time, because we are about to hit this evolutionary wall.
Well, so are we in the shift, Duane?
You bet we are.
Good.
We are in it now.
Great.
Yeah, no, it's happening. We're in the early stages of it, but you bet, it's underway.
Wow. This book is very exciting, and I thank you so much for being
a
paradigm shifter in my world, I'll tell you what.
Thank you, Veronica.
You're doing good work.
Thank you.
And can you tell people how to get hold of you and get more information?
Oh, thanks, Veronica. Yeah. If people want to be in touch with me, they can go to my website. It's very simple. It's www.duaneelgin.com. And it's D-U-A-N-E-E-L-G-I-N. D-U-A-N-E-E-L-G-I-N.com. There's another website I'm developing. It's called greattransitionstories.org. greattransitionstories.org. And it's filled with resources about all the things we were discussing here this evening.
Wow. Is it about what people are doing on the planet to help with the transition as well?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a very exciting thing. It's greattransitions.org.
Stories. Greattransitionstories.org.
Wonderful. We'll look it up.
Great.
Thank you so much for coming on to Paradigm Shifters and being a Paradigm Shifter.
Thank you, Veronica. And pleasure being here.
Thank you. And that was Duane Elgin of The Living Universe. This is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you so much for tuning in to Paradigm Shifters. Email me with any feedback you've got or recommendations for other guests or talking about Duane's presentation and his wonderful book. Veronica at veronicaentwistle.com. That's Veronica at veronicaentwistle, no H in entwistle.com. Thank you so much for listening. Good night, everyone.